This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, protesters gather in several cities demanding justice for Tamir Rice. An investigative reporter says Hillary and Bill Clinton deserve to go to prison for money laundering and influence peddling. And Black activists have a plan for good jobs and a clean environment in Jackson, Mississippi. But first, the corporate media's fixation with the attack on Paris seems insatiable, as if no place else in the world has suffered from terrorist attacks. Could it be because Paris is mostly white? Ajamu Baraka is a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Baraka's current article is titled, "The Paris Attacks and the White Lives Matter Movement." Baraka points out that the world capitals of death by terror are Nigeria, Iraq, and Syria, yet massacres in those places are not considered big news.
Because of the Eurocentric perspective, that the centering of Europe and the lives of people in Europe, all of the tragedies around the world get absolutely no attention. And especially no attention because for most of these tragedies, you have Western governments that are the primary responsible parties. So, you know, we hear nothing about very little about the continued bombings that are taking place in Iraq. We don't hear much about some of the so-called terrorist activity taking place in parts of North Africa that's been enhanced by their ability to be more effective at the consequence of the elimination of the government in Libya and these forces now being able to become more efficient in their killing as a consequence. We don't hear anything about the fact that you have a continued slaughter, and some people argue genocide, being committed against the Houthis in Yemen by the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Saudi Arabia. It's only the attention of the people in the West are driven to whatever convenient enemy or whatever incident that they define as being important for themselves and for the rest of the world, it can really just kind of go to hell.
What we hear from Paris and what we hear from U.S. commentators talking about Paris is basically a message that the French are blameless victims, and yet the French are the main colonizers of Arab people historically.
The French are not, in fact, innocent. The French people should be outraged by the fact that what they have now been forced to experience is, in fact, many of us believe, blowback from French policies, not only around the world and in particular places like North Africa, but specifically as a consequence of the activity that they have been involved in attempting to overthrow the government of Syria. And the fact that in engaging in that kind of activity, they have provided material support, intelligence support to some of the very same jihadist extremist elements that are now implicated in the attack in Paris. So if people in France and people in the West, they cannot be allowed to also embrace this innocence position. Their governments are involved in nefarious activities around the world. And so it can't just be when they feel the consequence of those activities that they're allowed to react with this moral indignation. No, they've got to take the responsibility of knowing what their governments are doing. And if they support that, then they have to take the responsibility of bearing the potential consequences of those kinds of activities. So I don't buy the innocence line. The French are not the victims. Of course, you know, we are in solidarity with all of the people who lost their lives, in particular ones who may be truly innocent. But I don't see the outrage that we thought should have been expressed when 147 Africans were murdered in Kenya. I don't see the outrage that should have been expressed to the activities of a Boko Haram in Nigeria. What I do see, though, are the responses by Western governments to take full advantage of those activities in order to advance their geopolitical interests.
But isn't it amazing that a country like France would play with fire to encourage the forces of Islamic fundamentalist jihad in Syria while it has its own large Muslim population?
You would think so. And I think that they are bearing the consequence of not only their policies in Syria, but their decades-long systematic discrimination and oppression of Muslim and Arabs in France. Look, you know, that attack took place, the raid took place in a French suburbs that I know very well. I have friends who live there. I have walked those streets. In fact, that is a community that I've lived in from time to time. And going there and living there, I have been subjected to the same kinds of discriminatory targeting by the state as many of our African brothers and Arab brothers have also been exposed to, the stopping, checking papers, the rough treatment that people are subjected to. It is an oppressive environment, and it's an environment in which the population of Saint-Denis and all of these various suburbs where you have these Muslim and Arab communities, they feel that oppression, and there is anger there, not only because of their treatment, but anger also because of their historic knowledge of how they ended up in France and the kinds of activities that the French government have been involved in over the years in their home countries.
And in fact, studies have shown that French people of Arab descent are stopped and profiled on the street more even than French people of Black African descent.
That's an interesting stat. You know, because I've been going back and forth to France since the 1970s, and in the 70s and 80s, it definitely was more Africans. So if that has sort of equaled out, if you will, or kind of tipped over to the Arab side, that's interesting, but not that surprising.
We also hear over and over again that the attack on Paris resulted in a greater loss of life than anything on French soil since World War II. But in 1961, French police attacked a peaceful Algerian demonstration in Paris and wound up killing 200 of them and dropping scores of their bodies into the Seine River, a bigger bloodbath than this past weekend.
Exactly. But see, that part of the history, of the narrative, is something that is never centered in the minds of the West or in the discourse around these so-called terrorist activities. The state terrorism of the French and most of the NATO governments, including the U.S., that's not part of the discourse. But it's part of the historical memory of so many of the victims of Western civilization, if you will. So we know and we see those contradictions. We know of the horrific treatment that Arabs and Muslims were subjected to in the War of Independence in Algeria. We don't forget about the activities of the French in Vietnam. And the list goes on in terms of French oppression. And we definitely don't forget about Haiti. So, again, the French are not innocent, like the West is not innocent. And so we just have to put these kinds of attacks in their proper historical perspective. And we have to acknowledge and talk about the fact that, especially when it comes to Black people, that we cannot allow ourselves to be caught up in the hoopla or the over-concern about what's happening in France. We've got to help our people to be reminded that there are ongoing tragedies that are the responsibility of the French and the U.S. government every day unfolding in parts of Africa. You know, we very seldom talk about the fact that we still have an ongoing human rights crisis in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example. So, no, we have to put this in perspective, and we've got to reject the notion that the only lives that matter are, in fact, white lives.
And we're not just talking about willful suppression of the facts of imperial oppression in Africa and the Middle East. Governments do that, and so do compliant news media. But the failure of white folks, many of them all over the world, to even recognize the humanity of other people, a kind of cognitive defect that you describe as a form of psychopathology.
Exactly. I mean, that's the only way that I can grapple with this, that basically the inability to recognize the humanity of other people, the false consciousness that results in Western Europeans believing that they represent the apex of civilization. How else do you explain that? How else do you explain their advancing the notion that they are the upholders of a humanitarian tradition while at the same time responsible for the most horrific acts against humanity known in human history, and see and feel the contradiction? How is it that we can see a candidacy in the U.S., Bernie Sanders' candidacy, being supported by some black people but many, many leftists, in which that same candidate has basically written off the consequence of U.S. warmongering in the global south as being unimportant? That basically for them is more important for him to be a viable candidate, even if it means embracing imperialism that is killing people every day in the global south. Why? Because those lives don't really matter that much. It's the old Madeleine Albright response that the price is worth it, as she responded to what happened in Iraq with 500,000 children being murdered as a consequence of U.S. sanctions. So it is this ability to reconcile yourselves with what many of us see as a moral contradiction that can only be described as a mental defect.
And every Republican and Democratic politician subscribes to the idea of American exceptionalism, which is itself an expression of white supremacy.
White supremacy and the same phenomenon. How in the world can one see U.S. history as upholding the highest principles of humanity and supporting the argument that the American experience is one that should be emulated by people around the world who believe in freedom and who believe in the advancement of the human project, if you will. For those of us who can still see and who have consciousness, it is in fact the opposite, that it is the U.S. experience that has to be rejected. It has to be critiqued. It has to be the model of what we don't want to create in a truly free and liberated and humane society.
Most Americans seem incapable of recognizing that this country has encouraged and financed and armed Islamic jihadists for the last almost 40 years.
They fail to understand that. That information has been brought to them. And when it has, they have not really accepted it. But at the same time, though, we see that they understand that the U.S. government has armed and trained and supported the Israeli government. And the American people will support that and support the glorious fight of the Israelis against their captive Palestinians and support that and justify it morally as something that has no real contradiction for them. So, again, this is another example of this ethical contradiction, this defect in the consciousness of Westerners or people who have been Westernized. Because when we talk about the process of Westernization, we're not just talking about Europeans or white people. We're talking about all of the people who have been subjected to this process, this colonial mental process also. They're the same ones who are running around with the French tricolors in parts of Africa and saying, just sweet Charlie or something. So that kind of sickness is something that is part of the colonial project and is reflective, all again, in the response we see from this latest attack. So that process of Westernization is something that cannot be reduced to one's assigned racial category. I mean, Barack Obama is exhibit A for that.
And it appears that people who are afflicted with this kind of stunted worldview see Israelis as white and Palestinians and Arabs and Persians or Iranians as something else.
Exactly. And that's what one sees when you go to the region, the specific ways in which people have been racialized. And in Israel proper, Arabs have been racialized now. They are, in fact, seen as a different race, not just an ethnic group, but a different people. And that perception is also a perception that many people in the West have, and in particular in the U.S. That's why it's been so easy for people like Benjamin Netanyahu to make this sort of Orientalist argument that these Arabs have a different kind of value system. These Arabs are the ones who will use their own people as human shields. They have no respect for life. They love violence. And it resonates with some people in the West because they perceive these racialized others as these human beings who represent a lower form of humanity. So again, these are the manifestations of this psychopathology that I talk about in this article. This is the consequence of white supremacy.
That was Ajamu Baraka, an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. Environmental activists were planning to hold huge demonstrations in Paris later this month to influence United Nations negotiations about climate change. However, French authorities have put the country under a state of emergency. Among those who plan to be in Paris is Kelly Acuno, whose Malcolm X grassroots movement colleagues are promoting a plan for sustainable development in predominantly black Jackson, Mississippi. It's called the Jackson Just Transition Plan. Acuno says his delegation has held on to their plane tickets.
Well, we're still planning on going. You know, we haven't been dissuaded by the events that happened on November 13th. Clearly understand that those things are happening for many people throughout the world on a daily basis. So we're just trying to make a clear assessment of, you know, what's going on from forces on the ground. You're not relying on the media to tell the narrative and tell the story. So just give us a clear sense of how we should move and what type of impact and intervention we might be able to make still at this point. So we're still putting that together, but our full intention is to go.
And how does your Just Transition Plan fit into a global framework for a sustainable ecology?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we had a clear sense of that before these attacks. It's a little bit murkier now. And the reason being, what happened on the 13th is really just a prelude and an excuse, quite frankly, for many of the Western imperialist powers to tie the agenda around the climate emissions and the climate change to national security conversations and discussions. And they want no more better than to, put up walls, fortify their borders, militarize the seas in Europe. There were already ample discussion about putting NATO gunboats in the Mediterranean Sea to stop the flow of folks coming over from Libya and from Turkey primarily and from other points. Same thing has been happening in the United States with the border with Mexico and to a certain extent in the Caribbean Sea for quite some time. They want to further legitimize this, beef it up, and just try to keep these kind of white fortresses at bay. But it's also very much tied to their program to really keep a lot of the global south or the third world from developing and to blame countries like China and India for the escalation in the global emission of carbon that their markets and countries and economies have developed, when it's in fact the Western nations, the United States and Britain and France, being key among them, who have the greatest climate debt since the industrialization of their economies going back 200 years that need to pay. So we are trying to figure out, number one, how do we stop this discussion around this tie between national security and climate change? Because that is kind of a prelude to green fascism, if you would, and that we definitely need to stop, because that means the wholesale destruction of our people on a global scale. So we need to find a way to intervene yet. I'm not going to sit here and say that we fully figured that out, but we are definitely going to be telling this story and raising this voice to anybody who will listen and try to do the work, you know, on the ground in our communities in Jackson and Mississippi and beyond to get our people to fully kind of understand what's at stake and how the imperialist powers intend on utilizing this agenda to further their own aggrandizement and to further grab and seize your power.
And of course, when the imperial powers talk about national security, they're talking essentially about protection of the extraction industries, oil and gas and
That's
such,
right.
and monoculture crops.
That's right. I mean, they have a full-on agenda. You know, they've been running it for decades, but particularly as the United States and Western Europe see some of their place slipping in the global economy, they're trying to find ways in which to kind of regain territory and keep their advantages and their supremacy locked in place. So they, you know, you got to look at this in the context of this austerity that they're trying to impose upon the world, keeping us all weak and poor and impoverished, privatizing all of the resources of the planet to the core part of their agenda. So it's not just a national security in terms of let's keep these folks out. It's also an agenda of, you know, how do we continue to exploit and rape the world's resources and keep them under our control? Because they're not trying to surrender that, you know, despite whatever kind of democratic rhetoric that they might put out. They fully intend on remaining the masters of the universe as they see it.
And how does the Cooperation Jackson transition plan fit into a different kind of worldview? And what's that got to do with black self-determination here in the United States and elsewhere?
That's a good question. I mean, the key thing for us is bottom line is, you know, this just transition is how do we gain control of the resources that we need to control our own destiny? I mean, that is the fundamental piece of what this is about. And for us, the critical thing is, you know, we don't want to continue being a part of the emissions problem because there's technology and there's knowledge out there to not have to rely on carbon, you know, and oil dependent type of methods of production. It does require some new kind of capital resources for us to get our hands on that in the here and now. But we want to point and get our people on board to say, hey, there's a different way in which we have to produce, distribute, and consume the goods and services that we need to live a life of dignity. And we are trying to focus on creating that new system on a local level to be a model for other communities throughout the United States and throughout the world to kind of emulate. We believe we have enough political strength still in our community to kind of push some things forward, but it's going to be one hell of a fight. But on a global scale, the transition that needs to happen from a carbon petrochemical-based economy to a non-petrochemical-based economy needs to happen pronto. I think by most clear scientific assessments, we have probably 10 years, if we're lucky, to reduce emissions on a drastic level before we get to 2 degrees, which is 3.5 Fahrenheit. Which scientists say, look, at that point, things become completely chaotic and our models can't predict the accumulated effects and what they will do to the planet and to human civilization, the complex life on this earth. And the plans that are really being discussed and the agreement that's being developed at the COP is supposed to be agreed upon at this COP basically kind of commits us on a global scale, commits the nations of the world to anywhere at about 4 or 5 degrees, you know, which is unmanageable, unsustainable, and outright deadly. So we are demanding a just transition on the global scale, which starts with reparations and the historic paying of the historic debt that the Western countries owe to the rest of the world for their 200 years of carbon emissions based upon slavery, the extraction of our resources around the world, the production and shipping of these cheap goods, the monocrop type culture that you mentioned. There's a major historic debt that they owe, and we have to struggle on a global scale for reparations in order to deal with that, which includes technology transfers, et cetera. And we need to make it clear, Glenn, that when they say that there's not enough money out there, there's more than enough money out there to make a major shift right now. What's missing is the political will to make it happen, and that is what we really need to try to focus on. And that was the thing that from day one and us going to Paris, that's what we were really trying to focus on. Because we've been encouraged, if you would, by how the movement has been growing, but it's a movement still that's not clear on its demands and time is running out. So we were just trying to make a small intervention with the Jackson Just Transition Plan to say, here's some concrete ways in which we have to manifest this. And we need everybody to get on board as soon as possible to make this happen and put a maximum pressure both on the United States government, the other governments of the world, and all the institutions of transnational capitalism. So that, I think, agenda is not going to change regardless of what happens or does not happen over the course of the next 3 weeks with this COP piece, we're going to have to focus on that and build that type of movement far beyond what happened in Paris.
So what are some of the key elements beyond broad reparations for creating a sustainable city, specifically the majority black city of Jackson, Mississippi? Mm-hmm.
Well, for us, the main thing it starts with, what our piece is really premised on, is that we want to make Jackson a zero waste and a zero emission city within a 10-year period. In our case, what it starts with, if we want to go into the zero waste piece, that one is a transition piece which calls for a massive recycling program, and it calls for a massive kind of composting program so that we can take, for instance, you know, all of the organic food waste that people produce every day in the restaurants and grocery stores, produce every day, put that into an organic process to turn it back into soil that could be used to heal the depleted soils around Mississippi and around the country. And soil is one of the kind of breaking of soil and the way agriculture traditionally produces monocrop industrial agriculture is actually a major source of carbon emissions. So we want to change that so we kind of reduce our footprint. But in the meantime, massive recycling of plastics and bottles and all those things, paper, that's a job creator and a quality job creator for our community. So all these different things for us, we need to be mindful when we're putting it out. It's not just stopping something. It's also how do we change this to provide a better life for our people at the same time.
Where have you gotten the most resistance to your Just Transition plan, and who are your closest allies?
The resistance is primarily from the Republican conservatives throughout the state. There's a kind of a two-pronged approach that they want. One, they want to stop us from doing it. And B, they want to kind of, their plan seems to be, let's hold off on doing anything until we absolutely have to. And then let's put ourselves in a position to exploit the cleanup that's going to happen, right? This is the other aspect of the kind of disaster capitalism ideology and program that we clearly see kind of outlined in Mississippi with the way that they're trying to move. And our closest allies, we've been building alliances with some of the unions in town. We've been building allies with the more traditional civil rights organizations in town. So, you know, folks are on board. I think the major question that our allies are posing to us, which is a legitimate question, is, you know, how are we going to pay for this? And we are arguing that we got to fight for the resources and we got to shift some things around within the city with things that we can politically control to utilize the resources at hand to fund some of this transition. So for us, we're talking about pushing like a participatory budgeting process, which was part of something that we had been trying to do, what we were planning on doing when Chokwe was alive anyway. But to continue on with that program, put some of those decisions directly in the people's hands through popular referendum, and then we can shift some resources around, defund some of the police activity, which is often quite useless and superfluous, defund that and then shift some of those resources over towards, you know, solarizing whole neighborhoods and creating efficient and energy efficient public transportation in the city, utilizing our terrible roads and the rebuilding of that to do it in carbon neutral ways and actually maybe put down some solar panels and things that have been innovated that could generate power, generate energy in a sustainable way. So the solutions are out there and some of the resources are out there. Again, we just got to figure out and organize the political will to carry it out.
You seem to be saying that the right wing may be giving lip service to recycling and other such solutions, but they want to give the contracts to big corporations and not to folks like you and the people that you work with.
Oh, that's absolutely what the intent is. Absolutely what the intent is. I mean, it's a pretty slick plan. So on the one hand, if you look at the program, they're denying vehemently that climate change is even real. And fight for it and, you know, do all this mass hysteria, you know, with the CNN and MSNBC and their favorite Fox to put out there that, oh, this is kind of a hoax, it's exaggerated. But in the meantime, their banks, their insurance companies, and if you look at all these kind of little startup and investment things that these very same forces, they're gearing up to exploit the green, quote-unquote, economy and the recycling economy. So on the one hand, they're trying to deny the public blind and confused, but on the other hand, they're preparing and putting themselves in a position to be able to exploit the solutions when that transition has to happen. So, you know, they're playing a very crafty game. We have to be just as sophisticated and get strong in our organizing to both expose it and in a place like Jackson, make sure that the community is not confused about where those resources should go and why.
So Black Power has everything to do with sustainable economic development.
Absolutely. In the 21st century, I don't think there's anywhere else for many of us in the United States to, at the very least, to go. None of the other type of industries are producing anything that is going to employ us very intensively. You know, as I've been arguing that we have to realize that the masses of our people, working Black people, are completely disposable to this system. So we have to come up with the concrete alternatives ourselves and utilize what strength that we have in our numbers, primarily, more so than anything, to exert the maximum amount of pressure we have to transform places like Jackson or places like Detroit, where we can use our numbers to control some levels of economic power to shift things to our advantage.
Well, there's no question that in terms of numbers, Black folks predominate in Jackson, Mississippi, but not all are convinced, apparently.
No, you know how that goes. It takes the time. Many people are still very much tied to notions that the white man's ice is a little colder, and that if you want to be successful, you got to kind of hitch yourself to their wagons. And then you got another set of folks, you know, I'm just generalizing, but you know, you can see the pattern. I think we all can. You got another set of folks who say, oh, those are good ideas, but they don't believe that we have the capability in terms of management experience and expertise to be able to kind of pull it off. Then there's just folks who are out there who are just cynics that ain't nothing going to change. So we got the whole range in Jackson, just like everybody else. But our main thing is we have to show and prove with the forces that we have and win those who can be won over, which we do believe is still the vast majority, that we can change things on some practical levels to build our strength and to build our power.
So the fate of the world, our common ecology, is not a white folks' issue.
No, not at all. I mean, we got to recognize that the front line of climate change, first and foremost, is Africa and the small island nations, you know, in the Caribbean and the Southeast Asian Pacific. A lot of them are going to be underwater within our own lifetime if things don't change. And then Africa, just kind of given its geography, with the Sahara Desert and its kind of constant expansion going south very rapidly, you're looking at some major impacts worse than they already are, because they're being felt already on a major, major scale. And we have to kind of then recognize that our enemies have already kind of positioned themselves to kind of deal with this shift and transition. That is why AFRICOM has expanded into the African continent to the degree that it has, pretty much under almost everybody's radar, because we haven't been given enough focus and attention in understanding what that is strategically about. It's about oil. You know, Africa has a lot of the untapped oil reserves, and it's about water. You know, a good part of what happened in Libya was about that aquifer just as much as it's about that oil. So we definitely got to wake up, do a better job of recognizing our common interests as the African people and start defending those interests.
Kali Okuno of Cooperation Jackson. The Stop Mass Incarceration Network, co-founded by Carl Dix and Dr. Cornel West, followed up 3 days of protests in New York with demonstrations this weekend in several cities to refocus attention on Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old killed by Cleveland police. The local district attorney accused Tamir's mother of having economic motives for demanding justice for her son. Carl Dix says the DA's behavior is proof enough that the system is rigged.
For this district attorney to impugn anybody's motive is just beyond disgusting. This is a guy who is heading a so-called secret grand jury process, who has leaked 3 reports that say the police who murdered Tamir Rice were justified in doing so because of the quickness with which the situation developed. And none of those reports have discussed the obvious situation. The only reason the situation developed quickly, with the police shooting Tamir within 2 seconds of arriving, is because as they arrived, they charged at him like they were some Wild West gunslingers who had their prey in their sights. Look, this is like Dred Scott 2015, because the Supreme Court said in 1857 that Black people had no rights that white people were bound to respect. In the case of Dred Scott, an enslaved African who had freed himself. Well, today, if they exonerate these cops who murdered Tamir Rice, it will be another statement that black people have no rights that this white supremacist system is bound to respect. And it is absolutely unacceptable and illegitimate, and that's why people took to the streets on November 22nd to call for justice for Tamir Rice and to call for an end to police getting away with murder. See, and when we held Rise Up October and brought together thousands of people from around the country, including more than 100 family members of people murdered by the police, we said this was not the end of something, this was the beginning, and we have to move from there and build on it, because the authorities have let us know they are doubling down on unleashing their cops to brutalize and murder people, and we have to respond saying we are going to build up our resistance. We ain't going nowhere. We're not going to negotiate with the Democratic Party about will they mouth some sympathetic sentiments about black people being murdered by the police while they continue to preside over it, because it has continued with a Democrat and a black Democrat to boot in the White House. So that ain't the place to look for solutions. The place to look for solutions is to independent action of the people and bringing together everybody who sees police murdering people as a horror that must be stopped and to act to stop it.
And it must be pointed out that Cleveland is virtually ruled by Democrats, largely by black Democrats, and yet no more telling evidence could be provided that the game is rigged than the prosecutor's own statement.
Exactly. I mean, he's greasing the skids to exonerate these cops, creating public opinion so that if it happens, then it's like, well, everybody's been made prepared to accept it. But we have to say we are not going to accept this. And look, I tell people every chance I get, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end this horror and all the other horrors that this system is enforcing on people in this country and around the world. And at the same time, I tell them we cannot sit back and accept any of these horrors. And I'm throwing my all into building up resistance that can beat back these killer cops that have been unleashed to patrol our communities like occupying armies and backed up every time they brutalize and murder people. We're going to be in the streets December 3rd, 1 year since the exoneration of the cops who participated in the televised murder of Eric Garner, because we had a video of that one. We're going to be going around the country in February with what we call a Stolen Lives Tour, taking family members of police murder victims to college campuses and communities around the country to open people's eyes to these are not isolated incidents, these are not tragic accidents, but a systemic horror of murder by police backed up with the full authority of the government. The Stop Mass Incarceration Network and Rise Up October ain't slacking up one bit. We're going to remain on the offensive and even looking at ways to take it even higher, because this must stop, and it is up to us to stop it. And anybody who wants to find out more information or get involved should go to the website stopmassincarceration.net.
And Tamir Rice, of course, caught national attention, but there have been many martyrs in Cleveland, and in fact, every community in the country has its own list of victims of police violence.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it is really something that people need to open their eyes to. Police have killed more than 1,000 people this year alone since January 1st. And even by police reports, which you can't go by because they falsify those reports all the time. And if you don't believe me on this, look at the case of Walter Scott, the man in South Carolina who was shot in the back as he fled from a cop. And the cop wrote a report saying he had to shoot Mr. Scott because they were having a tussle over the cop's taser. And he wrote that report not knowing there was a video of the incident. And had there been no video of the incident, Walter Scott's murder would have been recorded as the cop shooting a man with a taser, and he would not have been considered unarmed. But even their reports, which are often false, admit that several hundred of the victims of police murder were absolutely unarmed and doing nothing wrong. A number of them were children, as young as 6 years old. This is what we're dealing with, and it is unacceptable. And look, it's just got to stop, and it is up to us to act to stop it. Right now, there is a lot of concern sweeping the nation about people killed in the attacks in France. And that was an incident that I unreservedly condemn. It has nothing to do with revolution or fighting imperialism to end imperialism. But at the same time, the terroristic assaults that are targeting Black and Latino people disproportionately in this country are something that the authorities justify and want people to accept as the norm. And people have to refuse to do that.
Carl Dick says nationwide protests are planned for December 3rd, the one-year anniversary of the exoneration of the cop that choked Eric Garner to death in Staten Island, New York. Investigative reporter Ken Silverstein says the Clinton Foundation's newly released tax returns should land Bill, Hillary, and daughter Chelsea Clinton in prison. In an article for Harper's Magazine, Silverstein writes that the former and possibly future first couple are implicated in massive money laundering and other high crimes.
Well, in the case of Hillary's influence peddling, as Secretary of State, there's no question that she was paying particular attention to Clinton Foundation donors. And I can't prove it 100%, but investigators with subpoena power, I'm sure can. She was doing favors for donors to the Clinton Foundation. I come very close to just stating that flat out in several of the recent articles I've written. And now with, if you don't mind my using this language, the shit finally hitting the fan and all sorts of reports coming out as of Monday about the Clintons refiling years of fraudulent tax returns for their Clinton Foundation charity. I put charity in quotes. I think, you know, we're hitting critical mass now. It's, you know, I'm not a Fox News reporter. My politics are on the left. But this is outrageous misconduct and, I think, criminality by Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea, because they are trustees of the foundation. Hillary was. She actually stopped being a trustee as Secretary of State, so there wouldn't be a conflict of interest. But they're all legally responsible for any crimes committed by the Clinton Foundation, and I think we're going to see indictments, and there was definitely criminal misconduct at the Clinton Foundation that they are responsible for.
Well, how does money laundering work at the Clinton Foundation?
It's really simple, actually. I mean, money laundering is when you take dirty money, hide it, you make it clean. And as I reported yesterday at Harper's, there's a Canadian entity that's very closely linked to the Clinton Foundation. It's called the Clinton-Giustra Economic Partnership. And that partnership, in Canada, donors to nonprofits, they can make their contributions secretly. In the United States and most countries, donors can remain anonymous to the public, but they have to be reported to the government. There are some disclosure laws. In Canada, the donors have pretty much total confidentiality. So there's a bunch of money that flowed into this Canadian entity, and then they moved it to the Clinton Foundation in New York. But they didn't identify the original sources of income. They just listed the donor as a single donor as the Clinton-Giustra Economic Partnership. So if you're following me, they took dirty money from a variety of sources. I am told that some of those sources include members of the royal family in Middle Eastern countries, and the senior officials in the government of Equatorial Guinea, which is a brutal dictatorship in West Africa, which I started reporting on over a dozen years ago, coincidentally, and also from the Jacob Zuma government when Zuma was president of South Africa, officials in that administration, if not the president himself. So they all donated secretly to the Canadian entity, which moved the money under its name to the Clinton Foundation in New York. That is, money laundering. You take dirty money and you make it look clean. And by the way, Giustra, this name I keep mentioning, this is a guy named Frank Giustra, who's a total penny stock scammer who became a mining magnate with the help of Bill Clinton after his term ended in 2001. And soon after that, he started the Clinton Foundation after having turned in his law licenses because he lied under oath regarding Monica Lewinsky affair. And I don't think a president should be impeached for personal misconduct, but the president does not lie under oath, which Clinton did in a deposition. He actually recounts that he had a choice between telling the truth and lying, and he chose to do the latter. He lied under oath. That's a crime. So he had to surrender his law licenses. He starts the Clinton Foundation, immediately starts raising tons of money from, I think, Citibank and a number of other Wall Street firms that supported him as president. He got big speaking fees, 30-minute speeches for huge amounts of money. And since 2001, the whole foundation has been run in this completely opaque manner. They didn't even start disclosing their own donors until 2008 under intense public pressure. In any case, the Canadian guy Giustra got a huge mining concession in Kazakhstan. He flew over there on his private jet, and he took Bill Clinton along. And he got this huge deal from the dictator of Kazakhstan. And then he starts donating enormous amounts of money to the Clinton Foundation. And in another instance, which I write about yesterday at Harper's, Giustra and Clinton go to Colombia in 2010. Brutal, brutal history of death squad violence. They go to Colombia. They're there on June 9th, as I recall. They're starting some Clinton Foundation activities, and Bill is getting paid for speaking appearances. And on June 10th, guess who turns up in Colombia as Secretary of State? Hillary Clinton. She held a joint press conference with the president of Colombia, and basically, it's encouraging investment, and she's down there to show how great Colombia is. And she, in her own memoir, says that, it was a happy coincidence that she and Bill got to the vacation together. Well, was it a coincidence? If you line up Hillary's travel as Secretary of State with Bill's foreign speaking engagements, where he gets a ton of money, you'll find some shocking coincidences. And I think the congressional investigators and the Internal Revenue Service and the Treasury Department and the FBI, all who know about the misconduct at the Clinton Foundation, I think they should be looking at it a lot more closely. But they are looking at it, and I hope that these people are held accountable for their misconduct. They have committed financial crimes, and they should be held accountable. I mean, in any democratic country, it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. Allegedly, in theory, you are held accountable for your crimes. And thus far, the Clintons have gotten away with a lot of financial misconduct. And who knows what else?
Lay people who don't understand the complexities of tax law do understand the term influence peddling. And this is the most influential couple in the United States, certainly in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and Hillary Clinton could become president still if these various scandals don't end up with her indictment or her political implosion. She could become president, and if they get away with this, you're going to see this again. I mean, the Bill Clinton administration, people look back on it fondly because the George W. Bush administration was such a complete catastrophe and also in hoc to Wall Street, led us into stupid wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in my view. So, I'm not a defender of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. I think both are completely corrupt. We have no decent political choices in this country. We have two parties in debt or paid for and bought for by Wall Street, not just Wall Street, big corporate interest, control the government.
And in terms of conflict of interest, nobody seems to be talking about the fact that Hillary and Bill reign virtually as king and queen of Haiti and have done so for some time.
Excuse me, it's unbelievable. Thank you for pointing that out. I mean, the Clinton Foundation's relief efforts in Haiti are part of the fraud that I've only touched on that in my reporting. There are other people who've been pursuing that. But I mentioned in my piece at Harper's, quite interesting. You go, why isn't the Obama administration doing something to expose the misconduct of the Clinton Foundation? And then you go, well, Hillary is deeply implicated in this, and he picked her to be his former Secretary of State, and he donated his Nobel Peace Prize winnings to the Clinton Foundation for its Haiti relief efforts. I think that's the exact chronology. So Obama is a donor. He's a Democrat. It's his former Secretary of State who used her office to raise money for her family's foundation. And so it's no wonder, and the Obama administration is, in my view, just as bad as the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration and his father's administration and the Bill Clinton administration, in terms of taking money from powerful interests and serving those interests or being more dedicated, far more dedicated to those interests than to the American people who elected them. So, there's no political will to bring, as you say, the most powerful couple in America, or certainly in the Democratic Party, to hold them accountable, because they're powerful people. And in this country now, things are so out of whack that powerful people can get away with anything. And I really hope that Clinton serve as exhibit A, that maybe things are starting to change.
Investigative reporter Ken Silverstein speaking from Washington. Kenya Serrano, the president of the Cuban Institute of Friendship of the People, spends lots of time greeting delegations of visitors to her island. But this month, Serrano and other Cuban officials were on a tour of U.S. cities, starting in New York. Speaking at John Jay College, Serrano said Cubans are proud of the changes that the revolution has made in the lives of the people.
In terms of the comparison, imagine the situation of black people in Cuba before the revolution. In Cuba, in Havana, we have a Fifth Avenue also, similar to the one here. So black people in Cuba couldn't walk by the Fifth Avenue. Black people in Cuba before the triumph of the revolution could not work in the banks. They cannot work in the banks. They were not allowed. And we had a dictator in Cuba, Batista, was not black, but he was a mulatto, what we consider a mulatto, Luis Angel. You rectify if I'm not very well in my English today, but that president of Cuba, he was a dictator, but he was a president, was not allowed to go to the bourgeois clubs in Cuba. Being the president, imagine the kind of racism that we had in Cuba before the triumph of the revolution. We have more than 100,000 prostitutes, which was the destiny of the Cuban women before the triumph of the revolution, to be prostitutes, to be servants of the Marines coming from the United States. In Guantanamo, that is still occupied today, part of the territory, in Guantanamo, the Cuban part that is not occupied, permanently was a place where the Marines every weekend went to enjoy and to really abuse our women, our people over there. So, in conclusion, the revolution meant a radical change to all of that. And of course, to start a new model of society. And in the 90s, when we started what we call the special period, that it is the economic crisis, believe me that it was very bad for us. But in terms of the way we decided to overcome the situation, it was a very important lesson for us as a society. Because we said, again, we have to rely in our own efforts. We have to rely in the... To really feel that we have to do the Cuban model in a Cuban style, not to copy the Soviet Union or whatsoever. And I think that today, in terms of the achievements, to see that the Cuban gross domestic product will have an increase of 4%, approximately, the forecast that we have for this year, that's not bad. If we are coming from a deep economic crisis, that's not bad. We haven't been growing in our economy a lot, but a 4% for this year is not bad for us. Being a very fragile economy, like you know we are. But another thing that Leyma mentioned, and it has to do with the question of the foreign investments. Remember that we are a country where we have our laws, we have institutionality, and it doesn't matter if it is a U.S. businessman or women or people coming from China or coming from the United Kingdom. They have to respect the Cuban law. And when you ask us about that, well, they have to respect the Cuban labor code, for instance. We remember, because it is not the first time that we are having a law for promoting the foreign investment. It started back in 1995. We, at the beginning, it was a German willing to send to Cuba cruisers, los cruceros, right? And they wanted to select the workers for the crew. They didn't want black people, and they want to select very pretty women. And we say, no, we don't agree with that. You have to accept that it is Cuba, and it is the labor code of Cuba, the one decided who is going to be having access to those employments. So that's the way it is functioning since the beginning. In 1995, where the economic crisis was deeper. So imagine today that we have learned many lessons from the past, that we are stronger, that we feel that we are victorious in terms of preserving our main things. Are we going to do concessions? Not at all, because now we feel that it was the best decision we have ever made.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.